This is the Open Air Project.
If you want to do something, get out and do it.
And do it now. Do it while you can.
Life is just too short.
Okay, everybody, welcome back. Today on our podcast, we are lucky enough to have Janine Fliegel and Dwayne Diefenbach. Did I get that right?
Diefenbach.
Diefenbach. Close. I'm sorry. I knew I was going to mess that up. But they are running the Deer Forest Study. Is that the correct term for your study there?
That's the name we've given it.
That's what we call it.
Okay. So thanks for joining us. I want to point out first, though, that all of the people that I've talked to wanted to thank you guys for doing this study. And I was talking to you guys a little earlier about that. The reach you guys have, I think, is probably beyond what you know as far as the hunting community goes. Hunters love reading about deer. They love reading about the forest and the interaction in between the two. And then I just wanted to say thanks from all the hunters anyways. So,
well, thanks. I mean, the purpose of doing the blog was to try and share info as we learn it about in the project, because most of the time as scientists, we kind of go off and do things and come back 2 or 3 or 4 years later and say, okay, this is what we found. But this is an important project. Hopefully it's long-term. And there's things that we'd like to share as we go along.
So before we get started into the study, why don't you guys, starting with you, Janine, tell us a little bit about your background and how you got into this? And
well, I grew up in suburbia, so biology wasn't really my thing, but I ended up here. I did an internship doing deer transects or transects to look at deer use up in Maine. And from that point forward, if you work with deer, it's kind of like the mafia. You try to get out, but they just bring you back in. So from there, I actually worked for a graduate student catching his deer, and that's how I got into graduate school. And lo and behold, I ended up in Pennsylvania working for the deer and elk section as a biologist. So
that's good. That's really good. What about you, Dwayne?
So I always knew I wanted to be a wildlife biologist since I was in high school. So I went to school. I figured, well, you need to at least get a master's degree, and I had so much fun doing that, doing research, that I went on and got a PhD. And I actually avoided the mafia for most of my career.
But now you're in it and you can't get out.
I'm in it and I can't get out. So deer, you know, I've studied waterfowl, bobcats, a host of things, songbirds, and I avoided deer. I actually worked for the Game Commission for 7 years as a biometrician. And avoided deer there, but then I got this job, and I've been doing deer ever since. But it's been really good because Pennsylvania is one of the few states that puts a lot of resources towards their deer management and research. And so over the past 17, 18 years, we've been able to do a lot of good research, groundbreaking work.
So I'm going to ask you a kind of a weird question, but what has been, or maybe you don't have, what has been your favorite study that you've done so far?
Oh, with deer or with
deer?
Anything.
No, anything.
My favorite was I was able to work with one of my professors when I was still in school. I spent 6 weeks on an island that was 7 miles long and 3 miles wide looking at stellar sea lions in Alaska, off an island off of Kodiak. And that's when I found out that I like this field work stuff.
Yeah.
Because if you don't, then forget it. Then you're stuck.
Did you avoid deer in the beginning for a reason, or just something that you didn't do when you started?
Well, there's a lot of deer research out there.
Yeah.
And some of it just, it's so expensive to study deer that you're limited in sample size and numbers of study areas, that really the research wasn't that interesting. A lot of it was observational.
And I think a lot of the, and because so much research has been done on deer over the years, to get a study that really encompasses and means something, it's huge. It's large scale, kind of like the deer forest study. So that's why this study is so special, because it's that large scale.
So that was a little bit of a personal question. I didn't mean to go there, but I know there are certain projects that I work on and have worked on throughout my life that I enjoy more than others, and I figured I'd ask that. But what can you guys just go ahead and tell us a little bit about the study and explain what the purpose of the study is? And maybe, go into how the study is funded, if you can do that, mm-hmm. and then we can keep going from there.
How about I'll talk about it from my perspective?
I was going to say
talk about it from the game council side of things.
You usually do best with that.
So deer management in Pennsylvania, the issue is, how do we balance deer numbers? We have some different objectives in terms of management decisions. The Game Commission is responsible for managing deer in Pennsylvania. But deer depend on habitat to survive. And, 80% of Pennsylvania is private land.
Mm-hmm.
20% is public land, and a big landowner in Pennsylvania is the Bureau of Forestry, which is primarily forest. So, but they have a completely different mission. They don't have any authority to manage deer. They're responsible for managing the flora and forests. So the motivation behind this study for me was, we need to better understand the various factors that influence our forest conditions, and it's not just deer. If you've lived in Pennsylvania for the past 20 years, you've heard a lot about how deer are a major problem in terms of forest regeneration.
Yeah.
But Pennsylvania's also done a lot to address that problem, and so we're in a very different situation today than we were at the turn of this century.
Is that when you say that they've done a lot to address the problem? Are you talking like fences?
Saying beginning in 2002, we reduced the deer population by about 40%.
Yeah,
and so a lot of folks saw changes in the forest for the better. Mm-hmm. Forest managers saw tree regeneration improve, that they didn't need to fence as much. But there's still problems out there. And so the question for me is, we've brought the deer numbers down about 40%. Do we need to bring them down lower? Or are there other issues that we need to be looking at?
Is that a sustained 40%?
Pretty much. Things since about 2005, deer population's been fairly stable in the state.
Yeah, our goals are to keep, when we give recommendations for antlerless allocations to the Board of Commissioners, as part of the Game Commission and the deer and elk section, it's been to stabilize the deer herd in our 23 units that we have. So yeah, no changes, but it's a unit level thing, and deer don't just disperse themselves like a gas over the landscape. So there are more here, less there. I mean, that's just how it is.
Could you touch on briefly, I know that's probably going to be a long subject too, but could you briefly tell us how you track the number of deer in a specific area?
Sure. It all.
Obviously, I guess, how do you get your numbers? How do you know? As far as, I guess my biggest interest is the antlerless allocations. So how do you know how many deer need taken each year?
Well, it starts during deer season every year. An army of Game Commission staff goes out and we visit processors. And there we collect age and sex data, along with license information to get a reporting rate. So we know when we go to a processor, if I look at a deer, I age it, I sex it, I collect license information, we'll know if that deer is actually reported. So we get a reporting rate every year. It hovers, it's not the greatest, around 30-ish percent. It's based on sex of the deer. Males are reported at a higher rate than females are.
Sure.
Yeah.
So.
Because everybody wants to tell about the buck they shot.
Exactly. But it's still very low. Right. But it's enough for us to get a harvest estimate.
Okay.
And that's really what drives. We get harvest estimates based on unit. Then those harvest estimates are put into, we look at the allocation, what the harvest is, what it's been over the last 5 or 6 years. We look at a forest. We have a forest measure in there as well to see where that is. And then we estimate, or not estimate, but we have a target harvest per unit. But you also have to remember that if our target harvest is, say, 5,000 deer or antlerless deer in a unit, not every license kills a deer.
Right.
So the average is about 4 licenses for 1 dead deer. Okay. So if our harvest, or if we want a harvest of 5,000 times
25%.
4. Yeah.
That's interesting.
But it also varies by unit, too. So it's not every unit, but everything is unit specific, but that's about average.
But, you know, what Janine just mentioned touches on the deer forest study, and she said that that they use some metrics of forest conditions in terms of making recommendations. So what's the condition of the forest?
So it's not necessarily based primarily on deer numbers then?
Well, in fact, that's an important point. I mean, Pennsylvania's a leader in that standpoint. If you look up and down the East Coast, Pennsylvania's the only state that assesses habitat conditions when making deer management decisions. It's explicitly part of their deer management decision making.
That's very interesting, and I'm sure a lot of people have no idea that that's the case.
And so the purpose of the deer forest study, one objective, is to look at these metrics that the agency is using to assess habitat conditions. And what you would want is to measure something that responds to changes in deer numbers. So whatever you're measuring, if you bring down deer numbers, you would hope that you would see a response in improvement in habitat.
Right.
And so that's one of the things we're doing, is we're evaluating some of these metrics that the agency uses. In addition to just understand what kind of response in the habitat should we expect, how long is it going to take, and are there other things like soil conditions or competing vegetation? So that we're, what I'm saying goes back to where I said, is it, are deer the problem? And what's the interaction? So if you have really crummy soils, yeah, maybe you have to have fewer deer. Or maybe there's things that you can do in the forest that can counteract the poor soils when you're doing, you know, timber harvest management or other silvicultural treatments.
So you take that into account whenever you do your study as far as, I guess, as regeneration is concerned, the soil in the area, whether, you know, I'm sure limestone is much more fertile than, say, sandstone soil of the northwest or the central, north central PA. You take that into account?
Well, we're not just monitoring deer. That's the exciting part, right?
Yeah.
We have a crew out there every summer. We have over 200. Well, we have 200 sites. Each site has five plots where they're measuring vegetation conditions, and we're also collecting soil, measuring soil conditions. And so we're measuring soils, vegetation, and deer. And those are the three things that we're monitoring and trying to do some manipulation so that it's an experiment.
Yeah, that's interesting. Mm-hmm.
So does that covers the basis of the study, would you say?
Well, I think another important aspect of the study is the communication aspect, which is why we have the blog. I don't think any other study that we've done has had that aspect of it, and I think it's really helped us to try to get people to understand. It's so complex. I mean, this project is very large. It's very complex. It takes into account all those factors instead of just the one deer. I mean, everybody's always focused on deer.
That's the interest, yeah.
But, you know, there's so much more because it's not just deer, it's everything. Yeah. So.
Yeah, so in a nutshell, the Game Commission wants to know what should we be measuring to assess habitat conditions so we can make better deer management decisions at the wildlife management unit level. The Bureau of Forestry, which is the other partner in this project, is interested in knowing how do hunters hunt on our state forest lands? How do we use DMAP to manage deer at a smaller scale? The Game Commission is managing it hundreds or thousands of square miles. The Bureau of Forestry is managing, would like to manage deer at the thousands of acres. And so that's what they're interested in, is knowing is how do we make better management decisions at that scale. And then for me and my colleagues, Mark McDill is a professor here in the forestry program, Patrick Drohan is a soil ecologist. So the three of us are really interested in the more academic question of what's the interaction of soils, vegetation, and deer on our forest conditions.
Right. Right. So in that, you guys actually answered some of the questions that I had about, you know, using soil in your study and other factors within that. I did want to ask, where does the funding come from for this study?
Well, the cooperators really are the U.S. Geological Survey. That's my employer. Mm-hmm. The primary funders for getting the on-the-ground work done are the Game Commission and the Bureau of Forestry. Both of them are contributing funds to Penn State for collecting the vegetation data. The Game Commission does all the deer trapping, and they support grad students that are doing research on this project. And of course, Penn State, I'm here at Penn State, and they're providing support for this project in terms of supporting, you know, our students get their education here and that sort of thing.
Do either of you know what the mortality rate is whenever you're trapping those deer? Do you guys have any idea?
Oh yeah, we know what deer don't make it.
I mean, in caused
mean capture mortality.
Capture mortality.
Yeah. Yep.
Yeah, I mean, it's low, but I mean, you have the specific number, but I mean, that is one thing. We've always had very low capture mortality, and it's because of our protocols that we have in place because we've been doing it for a while. But it's in the,
when we started out, it was probably around 4%. I think we're down below 2%.
Yeah,
that's good. That's really good. So can either of you speak to the type of trap that you use?
Which one do you want to talk about? I want to talk about rocket nets.
Oh, good, because I don't want to talk about rocket nets.
Rocket nets sounds fun.
Yeah. Let's talk rocket nets.
Well, we use two types of traps. One is a clover trap, and it has nothing to do with clover that you eat. Clover was the person who developed the trap. Right. And our clover traps are basically a steel frame or some sort of metal frame with netting over it. It has a door that slides up, a netted door, and it has a tripwire. The deer walks in, hits the tripwire. In theory, mind you, the door slides behind them, and it just hangs out there. They're set in the afternoon, you know, the day before. They set open all night. Crews go check them first thing or the next day. It's amazing. We have some trail cams set up on these clover traps, and you'll see them go in, and the door closes, and they just hang out there and wait.
So it's kind of like a big have a heart trap, right?
Exactly, yeah. Exactly.
So before we get into the rocket net trap, how often do you catch your mature bucks in those traps?
Often enough. I mean, we get our collars out. How many collars we put out a year on males?
Well, we like to keep about 16 to 20 on air.
Mm-hmm. So we catch mature bucks. They're not fun to deal with in the traps, but...
And you capture them at a lower rate.
Yeah.
That's what I was going to ask.
Yeah, they're the hardest to catch.
Do you typically go after those at a certain time of the year?
No.
It doesn't matter.
No, our crews are trapping from the time they can start, which is usually the end of January through March. It all depends on the weather, though. Yeah. So they will, because not only are we putting collars out, they're also getting tagged, reward tagged. Yeah. So there are a certain amount of collars that go out, but then all those deer that we capture are tagged as well.
So, I gotta stay in our path here a little bit as far as our podcast goes. Everybody's gonna want to know after you set that trap, how quickly do the mature bucks come in? Because a lot of people believe that if you put human scent out there, mature bucks will avoid that almost completely. But you're not seeing that, are you?
We have trap-happy deer. Depends on the deer. I mean, we've caught males multiple times. I mean, they may not be 5-6 years old, but definitely have caught them. And if we put a radio or a GPS collar on them, we know if they're still in the area or whether they're not in the area.
And you don't typically see them leave?
No, I mean, we don't.
What, mean after they're caught?
Yeah.
No, we did have... We had one buck that like ran out of his home range for a week, but then he came home. Mm-hmm. But that was a long time ago, and that was with a drop net. That was a different capture.
Do you think that the reason that he took off for a while was because of that capture, or is it
The deer aren't doing that, and that was back when we had some of our first GPS collars, so we didn't have a big sample size.
Yeah.
So, you know, it was almost like N of one. This guy ran out of his home range for a week, and then he came home.
But we've had deer make other odd movements completely unrelated to capture.
Right.
So I don't think capture is what triggers them to do much of anything, especially that time of year. They're going to be conserving resources because it's the leanest time of the year. So they're not going to be making movements if they don't have to.
Right. Okay.
That's interesting that the scent doesn't play a factor in that capture a lot of times.
It is because it goes against a lot of the thinking in our community anyways.
The hunter community.
But it's a different time of year. So we're out there, the only reason we catch them is because they're hungry.
Exactly.
And there isn't a lot of food. If we had no snow and lots of acorns, they're not going to walk into our traps.
I see your point, yeah. Mm. Yep. So let's talk about the rocket trap then. I'm just going to call it the rocket trap.
That's fine.
It sounds like so much cooler. Right?
Well, yeah, it's... it's my favorite capture technique because there's explosives.
There's explosives.
But you have a large net. I think they're about 40 by 60 feet. and you have three what we call rockets that basically have a they're big heavy metal pieces of pipe that you can put a charge in them mm-hmm. and attach the net to those rockets, and then you have a detonator that you wait for the deer to come in to the bait, and we use corn. We've tried all sorts of different things, but basically shelled corn is the best bait. When they walk in to the net, in front of the net, then you fire it off. Now, you do have to be careful. You've got to be very patient because the deer all have to have their heads down, A, for safety, and B, because they can outrun this rocket net. And this rocket net is fast because I've tried to take pictures of it. And so I was there with my camera, with my finger on the shutter button, and pushed that down as soon as that boom went off. And that net was more than halfway out by the time my finger put that trigger down. And we have 50% of the deer outrun the net.
Yeah, we have.
Oh, no kidding.
We have video of it, and you watch it in slow motion, and it's like, it's amazing. I don't know how they do it, but they do.
Are you set in like
same way they duck an arrow?
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah. Are you set in like a ground blind when you're waiting on these deer, or how do you hide yourself?
It can vary. Usually, one person has to freeze their butt off.
Yeah.
In a tree stand or a ground blind.
Builds character.
You know? And then the other crews are usually in vehicles way off that they can drive in, because we actually prefer the clover traps, because you just have to, you can capture a deer, put a radio collar on it, and let it go in under 5 minutes once the crews are trained. But when you capture deer with a rocket net, you can catch multiple deer, you have to sedate them because they're all tangled up. And if you catch three or four deer, you can't process them fast enough. So we have to sedate them, untangle them from the nets, make sure they don't get too cold or too hot, and monitor their vital signs. And then we give them a reversal drug that reverses the sedative. And send them on their way. So it's a lot more work. It's riskier. It is fun and exciting, but
so why not just strictly use the clover trap then?
Because then he doesn't get to shoot the rocket.
Yeah, that is true. Well, it all depends on how the landscape too. Like in forested settings, that's where we're using clover traps because we can't set up a rocket net. But if there's a field or an opening, because the more you can catch multiple deer with a rocket net. Sure. So
and it's different time of day. So the clover traps, they're checking in the morning. The rocket nets, they're running at night. So if we can, you know, with personnel, we can have them doing both things in a single day, in essence.
That makes sense.
So let's talk a little bit about the next part, which is putting on the GPS collar. And I'm a little torn on why the telemetry side of it. Why track the deer? What's the purpose of tracking the deer in regards to forest regeneration?
So we really need to understand how many deer are out there. Mm-hmm. We're monitoring hunter effort. That's why we have signs up around our study areas asking people to self-report and let us know that they're hunting there. Mm-hmm. That's all we need to know, because we do send folks a survey asking about their hunting experiences. So if they sign up, it's an opportunity for them to tell us about their hunting experience and other information. But the purpose of radio calling the deer is we need to monitor how many deer are on the study area much more closely than what we would do, than either what the Bureau of Forestry might do or even what the Game Commission does at the management unit level. And so we're ear tagging deer to understand harvest rates, mm-hmm. Ear tagging, radio collaring deer to understand harvest rates, understand movements on and off the study area. The GPS telemetry has given us real insights over the scale at which you really need to, that the Bureau of Forestry needs to set up the size of their deer management units on state forest lands. And And then we're also using some other methods. So we have harvest rates, survival, reproductive information, and getting some density estimates that we can all use to monitor trends in this, in the deer population over time.
So that brings up an interesting point that I think people don't quite understand, is all the deer that you tag or collar are open to hunting, correct?
Open to harvest, yeah.
Yes.
Absolutely.
So, and to ensure that a tagged deer gets returned, or turned in, I should say, or reported, is there a some sort of bonus with those ear tags?
There's a reward.
There's a reward.
Yes, yeah. There is.
How cool is that?
That is cool.
So what is the typical reward for a tagged deer in this study then?
Do you want to say what makes people report the dollar amount?
Yeah. Every deer, whether it's radio collared or ear tagged, if someone finds that deer or recovers that, it's a $100 reward.
Okay. Oh. I have one more question to go along with that. Have you noticed a surge in hunters in these areas because of these rewards? Do you think more people were hunting these deer than would normally hunt that area because of the tagged deer?
I've been using rewards. I've used rewards on pheasants, turkey, multiple turkey studies, multiple deer studies. And we actually published a paper because we were interested in that very question. Are hunters more or less likely to shoot a radio collared deer? We had lots of anecdotal observations of in 2002 to 2005, we had what we called the buck study, when antler APRs were implemented in Pennsylvania. And a lot of hunters would claim that they never saw the radio collar.
Oh, really?
And we didn't know if that's because
blinded,
I was wondering
antlers.
How did they kill the deer if they were just looking at the antlers?
Yeah.
But the question was, were they just saying, you know, was that an excuse or what was that? And so we were actually, we had some deer that had small ear tag transmitters that you could barely see.
Okay.
And we also had reward tag deer. And what we found is that we could not detect any difference in harvest rates of radio collared deer versus reward collared deer.
Wow, I wouldn't have thought that. That's surprising.
And and the rewards have been over such large areas, and you know, it's really hard to see whether a deer is reward tagged or not. Mm-hmm. That we just have no evidence that it causes changes in hunter behavior.
Is there a way to tell that, say somebody has no idea that this study's going on, is there those tags, information them after you?
Yeah, there's a phone number.
Okay.
So when they get the call or the tag, it says $100 reward, call this number.
That would be, I could just see, you know, guys that are, you know, shoot a deer like that and find that tag, you know, that's something you, if you have no idea this is going on, you would be like, what? That's crazy, you know? Mm-hmm. I just want $100.
And a deer.
And a deer.
That's right. So I guess now, after we've gone through all of these questions about the study and everything like that, what our listeners most want to hear about, they love the telemetry part of it. They absolutely, I mean, everybody I talk to follows that. They want to know what, especially the bucks, they want to know what those bucks are doing throughout the day. So I have a bunch of questions about that. And if you guys can answer that, it'd be good. Do deer's ranges change considerably between summer and fall?
Yes.
Really? Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, well, we had that whole series of, can you pattern this buck? And that was what, September? The movements
started in September.
Yeah, the movements were in September and then through October, or September and October movements, to see if you could, all right, you see where this deer has gone for 2 months. Can you pattern? You're going to go hunting now. Can you pattern where he's going to be?
Yeah.
No, you can't.
No, I mean, yeah, that's a question.
Sorry to burst everybody's bubble.
But it changes only because of the rut.
Right.
So our study areas, ignoring the rut, males and females have on average about a 1 square mile home range. And during the rut, the male's home range on average doubles just over those 6 weeks.
Starting when?
Third week in October.
So it's almost like a switch is turned, right? And then they just start moving.
Well, every deer is a little different because he's responding to the females around him that are in estrus. And some deer start the third, or it almost looks like the middle of October or the third week in October. And other guys may not get going until the first week in November. But everybody's moving around by the second week in November.
Do you find that is a correlation in age of the deer? Do you think that the younger deer are moving before and more often than those mature bucks?
That's a good question.
Well, we only have 2.5 and older bucks collared.
Okay.
But I would have to say, given what we know about the breeding of white-tailed deer, I can't imagine why yearlings would be different.
No, I can't imagine either. And you have to remember, most of our bucks out there are 2.5 years old. I mean, that's the majority of the population.
Well, the idea behind that, or my question was, it seems to be...
Or adults anywhere, 2.5.
Right, that a yearling or up to maybe a 3-year-old would tend to move first and more often than a mature buck would.
That's the theory in the hunting circles.
Yeah, that, I just wondered if there was any correlation to...
We don't have any data on that.
Okay.
So you said they start to move in, you know, that third week of October or, you know, into November. But is there a change that you see between the, like you said, maybe the end of September and the middle of October? Do you see a real change there? Like when the velvet comes off, does their core area shrink, or do you just see a typical type of movement that time of year?
I don't think those deer that we have GPS collared, that we looked at their movements, there was nothing extraordinary about their movements, really.
No. And actually, we've been collaring deer since 2013. I'm actually going through and we'll be estimating home range size every month of the year for all these deer. And we've done a little bit here and there, but this will be pretty comprehensive because at this point we have
a lot of deer.
60, 100 deer that we've been following. So we'll be able to answer that question more, but... You know, they have a home range year in and year out. It doesn't change from year to year. The only thing that changes is during the rut. Males get bigger home ranges and females get smaller home ranges.
What about food sources, though? Do they change their area, obviously, you know?
Based on food.
Right. Like when the acorns fall, they're going to hang out in an acorn flat more than they would...
Yeah, I wish we knew. We don't have that detailed habitat data.
I mean, we don't know where it is in their home range. But then again, if it's the rut, doesn't matter what food is on the ground.
Do you notice, like, say, this time of year or as we approach the end of August, the hunting community, or we call them bachelor groups, those bucks will tend to stay together or run together. And then as we approach the start of the rut phases, they'll tend to break up. Do you notice any of that, that those collared deer will stay together for a certain amount of time through the summer?
Yeah, unfortunately, we don't have enough deer collared in one area to answer that question.
I wondered, my next question to that was, I wondered how far when that bachelor group breaks up that the individual deer then move away from one another before the rut phase starts. But
well, all I can tell you is that the deer have a home range that really doesn't change from one year to the next. Okay. And it's, other than a few weird ones, like we have this one guy that during the rut, he actually moves like 3 to 5 miles away, and he spends the rut in a completely different location. And then come Christmas time, he goes back.
Because home. He knows what that's where the ladies are.
He knows something.
He does that every season.
I think it's 3 years in a row now.
Wow. That's something.
And but
that's
that typical. Out of all the deer, that's the only
He's
male
the only
that
one
does
that does it.
He's got something figured out then. Right.
Well, yeah. Okay, so my next question would be, I noticed on the videos that you posted that there's a lot more daytime movement than I would have ever thought there was. Can you go into that just a little bit on what you see with daytime movement? Is it the same as nighttime movement?
I think everybody's surprised when they see the daytime movement. Mm-hmm. Deer are, you know, creatures of habit, so to speak. They're going to move in the morning, they're going to move in the evening, but there's still movement during the day and at night. I mean, not nearly as much, but there's still
there.
Yeah,
there's less movement during the day. Mm-hmm. There's more movement at night, but they're very crepuscular, right? Their peak activity is, you know, like an hour before dawn and a couple hours afterwards, and then it starts about an hour or so before sunset and ends within a couple hours after sunset.
A lot of the theory that we run into is that mature bucks, and you guys have some tagged, will only move a certain distance, and you can't, you won't know in what area, but as far as cover wise, but move a certain distance before dark. Do you guys see that at all, or is it just they get up a certain time and they start moving? Yeah, from their bed.
I don't know if I understand the question.
Yeah, so not sure. So things during the rifle season, things are very different than the rest of the year. The only thing I can say is I haven't observed movements like they go back to the same place to bed down. They have a home range that they meander around and stop, and when they're bedded or not is really hard to say.
Just kind of where they end up at the end of the day.
Yeah.
Well, you can say something to the places they choose when they bed.
Yeah.
You know,
but you can't physically tell when they're bedded. I mean, you can't.
Please talk about that.
Well, you just talked about it last weekend.
Yeah.
About.
You mean in the rifle season?
Yeah, what kind of spot do they pick?
Yeah, so the males are, the one thing we don't know is like how much mountain laurel or rhododendron there is. That would be the cat's meow to know that. But what we do know is that they're picking high spots on the landscape that it turns out they found that they're unlikely to be disturbed by hunters, but those high spots, usually they can pick up anything, any scent from the prevailing wind direction. Mm-hmm. And then to the east of them is a steep drop-off that if they jumped off that within 30 seconds, they're long gone.
So you see this on the leeward side of the mountain, and typically looking out over an area that they can see pretty well.
Well, I don't know if they're looking out over something, but if you look at a topo map, it's the peak of some ridge or, you know, some land's topographic feature. And it's usually on the, you know, like, so up in our northern study areas, which is in the big woods, that habitat is what they call the Allegheny Plateau, because the mountains are flat on top, and then there's steep drainages where erosion has created these ravines and such. And so they're going to pick a spot on top on that plateau, but on the edge of a steep drop-off where they can, to the east.
What they call the military crest, which is just that spot on a little bit down the mountain, but not just be where you can, where that steep drop off is. Mm-hmm. That's interesting. Now, you only see this though during rifle season. Mm-hmm. You don't see any correlation to bedding during the rest of the year.
You can watch these deer through October and they just look like they were walking around in September.
Yeah.
So the archery hunting, there's not enough pressure to cause that behavior.
We often wonder about that.
Yeah.
That's been a big, him and I have actually had, not arguments, but we've had differing opinions about that.
Spirited discussions.
Yes.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, that's interesting to know, at least from what you've seen anyways. And I'll come back into some of those other questions. I want to ask you quickly about predation and what you see in your studies with black bear and coyote predation. And maybe you could talk about what the percentages are of your study anyways, because that's what you can speak about the most, I would imagine.
I'll talk about adults. You want to talk about the fawns? No. Or you want to do the other?
Because I know hardly none of our adults get predated. I mean,
really?
Yeah. Once they're what? Reach that first?
8 months.
Eight months old, year old. Then they're pretty much safe. I think we've documented maybe 2-3.
We have a database of over 5,000 deer that we've captured since 2000. And the number of predations is probably, I could count on two hands.
Right.
Of adult
deer. Really? Of adult deer, yeah.
And those adults, were they taken by black bear or were they taken by coyote?
A lot of times it's hard to tell, but my guess it would have to be coyote.
Yeah.
Yeah, bears should be sleeping.
Yeah.
Oh, at that time.
Yeah, because most of the time it's in the winter.
Oh, okay.
I would have thought that would be way higher. I didn't realize that a coyote, well, we all think that.
So what about the fawns then?
Well, lots of things eat fawns.
Yeah.
You know, bears and coyotes are the top ones. When we did the fawn study back in 2000, 2001, bears and coyotes were neck and neck. Our current study, bears are ahead of coyotes in the northern area. And it's actually bears and bobcats in the southern, which is in the just south of State College, Rothrock and Bald Eagle State Forest. But it's, you know, people wring their hands over it, but what we're finding is that we have pretty decent survival rate. I have a grad student working on this project right now, and she went back through the literature, found all the fawn survival studies that she could find, and what she found was that survival of fawns increases the more ag you have on the landscape.
Yeah.
So in the Midwest, where it's practically all ag land, you have the highest survival rates. Where you have contiguous forest, you have the lowest survival rates, and it's a very nice relationship. The interesting thing is, though, that Pennsylvania, our four studies out of the 20, we have like four different study areas where we've estimated fawn survival. And those survival in those study areas are always above the regression line, which means our survival rate in Pennsylvania is above average for the country.
I could see that the browse in Pennsylvania would lend to that, I would think, right? As compared to, it's pretty thick here. I know when I go to other areas of the country, I always think, man, it just doesn't look as lush as it does here. I could be wrong. That's just me.
No, there's something to that. I think Pennsylvania, our colleague Chris says Pennsylvania's the sweet spot.
Oh, yeah, for deer. Mid-Atlantic. I mean, for deer survival, yeah, absolutely.
Right, you think about it. We don't have that harsh of a winter, so our deer don't yard up.
Right.
They're not nearly as stressed. Where we have better habitat conditions in the southern half of Pennsylvania, 30 to 40% of the fawns get pregnant. That is, they're six months old,
That's
and they're getting pregnant. And we have some of our soils are poor, but you compare that to Florida, you know, the sandy soils in the coastal plain of the South. So we have pretty high reproductive rates. So, and we don't have some of those, well, we didn't used to, climate change is affecting that, but we didn't have EHD or some of these diseases historically. So really we're in the sweet spot. We don't have the severe winters. We don't have the really poor soil, sandy soils down south, or the diseases. Yeah, that's why we have high harvest rates. Pennsylvania's in the top five.
So since we're talking about survival rates, that's a good segue into CWD. And I'd like to know your thoughts on that. And I don't, you guys don't have a study area that has CWD in it, do you?
No, not yet.
Okay. How do you see that progressing in Pennsylvania? How fast do you think that will progress? I know that's a hard question to answer.
As fast as a deer can walk. I mean, really, that's how the disease spreads. Mm-hmm. By, you know, it's transmissible from animal to animal, and then of course soils can be contaminated as well. But, you know, with regard to spread, what play the lottery? Is that one infected animal going to disperse? Is it going to be a yearling male that's going to disperse 4 miles or 40 miles? We did have one, you know, one time disperse 40 miles. I think that was the longest dispersal distance we have on record. But how it's going to progress, I don't know. If we can look at other states and see that their situations are not improving.
Right.
So if we use that as a template, you know, I don't know if ours will either.
Okay. So let's go back into some other behaviors of deer. Is there any thought on reducing, or I should say shortening, the time of the data collection points that you guys are using on those collars?
I mean, how many points? And oh, we do that
how
during
often,
during rifle season.
Yeah.
Oh yeah.
Well, as technology and batteries get better, we can do more of that. But right now, our collars last at least 3 years if we get one location every 7 hours from late December through September, or through October to October 1. In October and November, we get a location every 3 hours. And then during the rifle season, we get a location every 20 minutes.
Okay.
So we're getting, you know, 2,000 to 3,000 locations a year on each deer. It's always a trade-off, right? We can get really intensive locations, but then the battery dies sooner. Right. So we're always making a trade-off there.
At that rate, at your average rate that you're taking those points, how long do those batteries last?
Well, I think if we took a location every 7 hours or twice a day or two or three times a day, I think they could probably last like 7 or 10 years or something.
Whoa. Yeah. Okay.
But I think it's pretty fascinating to get more detailed locations. And quite frankly, I expected our deer to be dead.
They don't die.
Yeah. I mean, what we found with our current study is we're experiencing some of the lowest harvest rates that we've ever recorded in Pennsylvania. So when we started this study and you asked me, what's the harvest rate on our bucks? They're all 2.5 and older. Almost all of them should be legal to harvest. I would have said, well, we expect about 60% of them to be harvested every year. And what we're seeing is that the harvest rate's actually around 15%. Mm-hmm. And that means that a 4.5, 5.5 year old buck in our study areas is not unusual.
Which is unbelievable in this state. I just would never have thought that. But, you know, we're seeing that now. We see a lot more mature
bucks
than we
And the older you get, the smarter you get, as if you're a white-tailed buck. Do you think guys might be shying away from these study areas?
Well, he already answered that and said that they don't see any correlation with that.
Well,
I think I just said this on our Twitter account the other day. It's like, it's a game of hide and seek, right? Mm-hmm. But for the deer, it's life and death hide and seek. So you better be good or else you're dead. So they're really good at it.
And these deer are not, I mean, these are not easy places to hunt. And these deer have figured out where to hide. You know, I'm not saying that these deer are consciously thinking, hey, if I go to a top of a ridge where I have the scent, but what they've learned is the deer that we've caught and collared have already survived two hunting seasons.
Right.
So they somehow they got lucky and they ran to some spot and they learned, hey, if I run here, there's all this commotion going on. I'm not gonna be disturbed up here. And that's, they just have this hiding spot that they know where to go. That they've, you know, I'm not going to give them lots of forethought and credit.
Well, I didn't really want to say this, but it's, you're pretty much, you can go on there and look and see where these deer are. It's not like you're hiding their location through these YouTube videos and stuff, right? I mean, it's amazing to me that somebody hasn't figured out
how. Well, to be honest, most of them are dead before I put the video up.
But I've thought
about that, you know. Quite frankly, I don't know, even if I knew where that deer was, I don't think I have any insights into how I could harvest that deer.
I'm sure it would be difficult, especially if you're talking some of the mountain world that's on these.
Yeah, even if you know where they are, you have to get to them.
You're not sneaking through that.
So you can't. I'm not going to go up at midnight before and get there before that deer is, because I'll be frozen to death before it's legal to hunt.
Yeah.
And there's no way I can sneak up on those deer where they've positioned. You know, the thing that I've taken away from studying these deer is two things. One, don't give up on the afternoon hunt, because we're seeing a lot of these deer by 4 o'clock in the morning, they're in their hiding spot. And they don't leave that hiding spot till 10 o'clock, but by 1 o'clock, almost all of them are moving again.
In the afternoon.
Mm-hmm. In the afternoon.
Wow.
Sleep. No matter what time of the season that might be, they're doing it from October to...
Well, I'm saying during the rifle season. Okay. They're not moving during the rifle season when there's all that heavy hunting pressure. They're not moving from 4 a.m. till 10 o'clock in the morning or noon. But come afternoon, they're moving again.
Yeah. That's amazing.
Do you see that also though in the archery season too?
No, not at all.
Okay, so once they realize that pressure's there, they hunker down, but they have to move.
Well, yes and no. So if you look, even through the rifle season, they're still most active in the morning and the evening.
Yeah.
It's just that they aren't as active. And then they also take advantage of that hiding spot.
Right.
In fact, I was just talking to where Janine did her master's work, and they have hunts for guests. And they used to, he told me, he said, we used to bring people in the night before, they would hunt all day, and then they would hunt the next morning. He said, we found that we had better success if we brought them in the first day, they hunted the afternoon, and then they hunted the full next day. So they got two afternoons and one morning led to higher success rates than two mornings and one afternoon.
That's interesting.
Very interesting.
So back to some of the movements, do you see deer moving in regards to the wind at all?
I had an undergrad do that a couple years ago, look at our data, and she found almost no effect. And we were looking at October. Because mm-hmm. when you can't really look in the rut, because they're just running around, right? Yeah. But so we looked at October and archery season, right? Mm-hmm. And how did it change? But, you know, October is a beautiful time of year. And it's very rare that it's really windy.
Right.
And so she didn't even have very many windy days. Mm-hmm. And what she did find was very little effect. Now, we've got several more years worth of data, and I have another undergrad who's asking the same question. And we have a lot more data since that time. And she was just working on that this week. She hasn't even finished it, but the preliminary results suggest almost no effect.
Well, our question there would be more or less toward the wind direction than the speed of the wind. So the idea is that a buck's bedded so he can smell what's behind him. If that wind direction changes, would there be a correlation of movement according to the directional change of the wind?
Well, I haven't answered that question, but I guess we could see. So they have a home range, right?
Yeah.
See if they're on one side or the other.
So we could see if they're on one side or the other, depending on which way the wind is blowing. Yeah.
I can tell you that is the one question that most people want to know. Because
write it down. We'll have to do a blog post.
There you go.
The problem is you need to know where's the boundary of their home range, and you don't.
Yeah.
You'd never know that. But
the idea is that they switch sides of a ridge, or they move in accordance to that wind so they can smell. Now, if the wind changes, they can't smell what they smelled before the wind change. So they move with the wind according so they can still smell their backside.
The thoughts behind a lot of these questions are, as hunters, as archery hunters, it is difficult to pin down a buck in a food area, right?
Mm-hmm.
Or a trail. But if you can figure out what he's doing with the wind or with his bed, then you might have a chance. Mm. That's the idea behind these questions.
I'm not sure we could look at that, though, only because of like microclimates with the wind. You know, the prevailing wind direction might be,
you know,
from the east, but where he is, it may not be that way.
And then you have thermals.
Exactly.
So that's another point that would be difficult.
We need GPS collars that record wind direction.
Yeah.
That'd be good. We would love that. Do you see any kind of movement with regards to temperature? Let's not talk about the rut. Let's talk about in October. Do you see more movement? On cooler days.
Like a cold front. Yeah, cold front.
Yeah, so that's a different question, though.
Yeah.
And that's something we want to get at. And we haven't had time because it's kind of difficult. Because basically, that's a question I've wanted to answer, and I don't have the answer for you. But so, for example, do they move more or after a front comes through?
Yeah.
And it's kind of tricky to determine when did the front come through, because unless we sat down and we're keeping notes, we have to. We can get all the weather data we want off the internet, so we really need to define. Okay, how can we say that when the front came through, and then we need to look at movement before and after the front, and that's something that we hope to do. We just haven't gotten there yet.
So here's a question that I don't have on my sheet, but I just thought about. We've all been riding down the road, and it's the middle of the day, or some odd time, and all the deer are standing out in the fields eating. Do you guys have any idea what causes that? Could it be moon position?
No.
Okay. All
right. No, in fact, we have a blog post coming out. I guess
Let the catting out of the bag. Well, it's not any different from the first answer we gave, though, right?
No, there's statistically, we can detect an effect, but it's so small. It's because, you know, we've got so many locations. But on a moonlit night, they probably make an extra trip to the bathroom.
Okay.
Right? So that's how little. I mean, they're traveling, you know, a kilometer a day, and you're talking an extra 50 or 60 meters.
Okay.
And they might walk 40 or 50 meters less on average during the day when the full moon. There's just, if you look at the movements over the course of a of the day, whether it's a full moon or a new moon,
there's no correlation whatsoever.
There's no difference at all.
But do you have some kind of idea of why those weird days where you're riding down the road and you see the deer, all the deer are out eating?
They're hungry? No, I don't know. Perhaps it is front related, but I mean, we can't really say for sure.
Yeah, I guess you don't see a correlation between a heavy storm coming and feeding before the storm. Or
yeah, they said they're going to look at
that. Would be front,
that's something we're going
to. I guess in the moon phase thing, though, the we're talking more or less like not so much if it's a full moon or a new moon. It's
but
the overhead
clock
underfoot
position.
Have you ever looked at that? And the overhead and the underfoot are within an hour of one another, or right about the same time. They claim that the deer will move like that, but
I'd like to see their data, really, because
yeah.
Well, it's not. This is still more or less on the hunter end of things. This is just
a lot of theories going
theories
around
that hunters
there.
Have, and you know.
And you guys have some answers, and, you know, it's...
Not too many people have the data. That's why I didn't know if there was
Yeah, I've heard that underfoot and overfoot thing. You know, you're saying the moon's above the horizon or below the horizon. Mm. And I'm trying... I have a hard time... How do I come up with some hypothesis to test with my data?
Yeah.
And the other thing is... The moon and sunrise are so correlated, sunrise and sunset. So if you pay attention, full moons come up right after sunset.
When are deer most active?
When deer are most active.
Yeah.
So, and we in the analysis that she did, we tried to separate out that confounding effect and basically couldn't find any. Once, you know, the main thing is how close is it to sunrise or sunset? That determines whether they're active.
Yeah.
Relative to that, the moon has like no effect.
Okay.
That answers our question pretty good. Do you see a change in movement whenever after the leaves drop? Obviously, rut is going to play a part of that. So it's a hard question to answer.
Yeah, I would think food would play a big role in that, and we just don't have the data to answer that question, you know.
I mean, but look when the leaves drop at the end of October.
Yeah,
what's going on?
Yeah, it coincides with the rut.
The rut.
Yeah.
Yep. So the other question was, how much do human boundaries affect deer movement? Will they avoid camps, roads, hiking trails, things like that you see?
No, physical features on the landscape will affect where home ranges are placed on the landscape. So a lot of times when you look at buck home ranges, in fact, where we've had two bucks next to one another, what splits their home ranges apart is a stream.
Oh, okay, yeah.
Or it might be a power line or a pipeline, right? So a female there might be a pipeline going up over a ridge, and her home range abuts that pipeline just because it's a physical feature. She walks up and down the pipeline, but she rarely goes into the woods on the other side. And that's just a behavioral thing. A lot of animals that are territorial or even just have home ranges, they have features on the landscape that define the boundaries of that.
And how much territorial activity do you see within deer? I mean, I've seen does fighting, standing up and using their hooves to fight. And that's typically over a feeding area, from what I've seen. Do you see a lot of that? That they won't intermingle like that? Or I guess the real question should be, how does territory affect deer densities?
I think it's those interactions are more social. So it's a social hierarchy. I mean, with regard to deer on the landscape, it's just wherever their home range is where their home range is. And there's overlapping upon overlapping and mm-hmm. things like that. It's not like a coyote where they go around and mark the corners.
Right.
Yeah. They're a social animal. I mean, mm-hmm. that's where their hierarchy
so
is.
I think we need to talk about some definitions. So
yeah.
when I say home range, I mean something different than a territory.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So a territory is usually defended, and a home range is just where the animal is. And so deer aren't, the only time a male is defending a territory is when he's following a female in estrus. Mm-hmm. And so
his territory is her.
The territory is moving around.
Yeah.
He's defending her. We've had males that have almost exact overlapping home ranges. Adult males with identical home ranges.
Wow.
So there isn't this space. Well, with females, there probably is exclusion during the fawning period.
Yeah, yes.
Right? They're seeking isolation.
Mm-hmm.
So in a sense, there could be some territory. In fact, we believe that's why young yearlings disperse, is because the female is seeking out isolation as she's ready to give birth and tells her young to get lost,
mm-hmm.
Both males and females. But in general, there really isn't that defensive space in deer.
Those bucks that have that overlapping home range, do you have any data as to the age of those two deer? Are they, is one going to be typically a younger buck and another one, say a mature buck, like 5 year old, do you not know?
Well, we don't have we don't have enough deer collared in one area.
Okay.
You know, we've got a sample of deer, and we just happen to have two deer that had exact same home ranges, and okay. they were both 2.5 or 3.5 years
so
old at least.
They're just about the same age. Okay.
You guys have answered a lot of our questions, and we really appreciate it. Is there anything you guys want to talk about?
I would say, just in conclusion about this study, is that it's not just us studying deer, but hunters are the primary mortality source on white-tailed deer. The second primary source of mortality is vehicles, and after that, it's almost nothing. Right. So after you get past hunting and vehicles, your odds of dying are really, really low if you're a white-tailed deer.
Right.
So understanding how hunting plays a role in this research that we're doing is really important. And the cooperation of sportsmen is mm-hmm. essential to the success of this project. So that's, one of the reasons why we're trying to get this news out is that we need people to cooperate, because that will help us, which will help the Game Commission and the Bureau of Forestry do a better job of managing deer.
These studies that you're doing, if somebody lives in the study area, is there a place they can contact you to report information as far as how many deer they see per hour or things like that?
Well, what we really love to get is
pictures
of our collared deer. So we catch a deer and let it go, and we almost never, ever see it again unless it's dead.
So you'd like to see some trail camera pictures?
Oh, yeah. If you go to the website, we've posted some that we've received,
mm-hmm.
But we would love to see pictures of our deer.
I mean, that's how we were able to know that one yearling dispersed 40 miles. Someone caught him on a trail cam. You know, it was amazing.
And as 40 far as,
miles. Yeah.
That's unbelievable. But as far as hunting those areas now, they contact you every time a hunter is to contact you every time they go into the woods, or is that just a bi-season
no,
thing?
No. Just if they go to those sites, there's signs up everywhere with a toll-free number to call.
Okay.
And they just have to leave us their CID number, you know, on their hunting license, and that's all we need to know.
Okay.
That I'm hunting deer in this study area. Mm-hmm. Whether it's buck or doe, it doesn't matter.
Okay.
All right. Steve, do you have any final thoughts or questions?
Just that this was really
informative.
Yeah, very informative. And I think it opens up a link between the hunters and the game commission and it's really cool to see it all come together, I think.
So I do have one final question. So far, what are the conclusions of the regeneration part of it, in that do you see the majority of the regeneration problems coming from deer? And are there other factors that you see that play just as big a role or a certain role in that?
Yeah, so I have a PhD student who's finishing up this within the next 6 months, hopefully. And her focus has been on looking at vegetation and soils. And one thing, and her research has focused mostly on our southern study areas, on the Rothrock and Bald Eagle. And it's clear there that soils are playing a huge role. And so we're finding pH, as pH drops, instead of cations like calcium and magnesium that are really important to plant growth cycling, when pH drops, all those cations get flushed out of the system, and what ends up cycling is things like aluminum. And aluminum is toxic to plants. Mm. And we're seeing pH levels that almost all the plants on those forests are experiencing some level of aluminum toxicity. And we're also seeing some strong interactions with other manganese, which is another metal that's important to plants and animals at very small doses. But as pH drops, that increases cycling in the system. And so there's some interesting interactions between manganese and aluminum that are explaining some of the patterns in vegetation that we're seeing. So I think we're learning a lot. We've been going for 5 years, and we're just starting to get some insights. The Game Commission has just committed to funding this project for another 5 years.
That's great.
So I think if you ask me that question in 5 years from now, we'll have a lot more answers.
We'll have you back on here in 5 years.
But the bottom line is, yes, it's not just deer.
Okay. That's what I had anticipated your answer would be. I know there are people, I had one person ask, why didn't you involve elk in the study? I just don't think that the numbers of elk are high enough, and that's not your study area. I do want to know why you chose those areas.
We chose them because
large contiguous
they're large areas. Contiguous forests. Typical. So the two up north are primarily northern hardwoods for us, and we picked two sites that are very similar in terms of the timber harvest operations and the plant composition, and the same thing for the central Pennsylvania. We looked at other sites. There are lots of things that affect our forests, like invasive plants. And some of our other forests, like down in Tuscarora, we were looking at studying. That's down Perry County, Franklin County, that area. But that forest is experiencing a lot of problems with invasive exotic plants. And so that would just put another confounding factor in there that would make it more difficult to try and answer the questions we were really interested in. So that's the justification for picking those study areas. We've got two in the Oak Hickory Forest and two in the Northern Hardwoods Forest. Mm-hmm. So we've got the two major forest types covered in, that occur in Pennsylvania.
And which one of those areas do you see the problems being the worst as far as regeneration?
The southern ones, they're the Ridge and Valley. So you've got those sandstone ridges and lots of mountain laurel, and timber harvest operations are difficult. If you look at Susquehannock, they're able to do a lot more timber harvest up there. So lots of things make the two areas different.
That mountain laurel plays a big role on both ends of that. I think, too, that it's hard to harvest deer in areas like that, too.
Yeah, it really is. And what Steve and I see, or what our thoughts are anyways, is that in a lot of those areas where the mountain laurel is, the deer don't necessarily have to move very far because they have cover, and in most of those areas they have good mast crops during the fall. There's red oak and white oak right there in those mountain laurel areas, from at least where we live anyways.
Yeah. So, I mean, hunters tend to avoid those places too, which I imagine if deer are causing a regeneration problem, that poses an issue just on the mountain laurel basis.
Yeah, that's the competing vegetation. You know, mountain laurel is going to inhibit regeneration in and of itself.
Yeah.
Okay, well, thanks for joining us. I think everybody is going to enjoy this podcast.
Yeah, absolutely.
So, all right, thanks.
Thank you.
Thank you.
All right, so this is a portion of the podcast where Steve and I give our beer recommendations. As I had said before, I did a trip out west and I stopped in Portland, and probably the coolest place that I was at was 10 Barrel Brewing Company. I don't know if they're a brewing company. 10 Barrel Brewing. A really cool deck up top that you could go up there and check out the city of Portland. Really cool. Really cool. But they had some good beer. I tried a couple of their beers. But the one I want to recommend is Apocalypse IPA. So, Apocalypse was, I mean, it's an IPA. It was good. It was right up there with all of them. You know, I personally, I think sometimes when you're in an environment that is appealing, then it makes the beer taste better.
Yeah, I agree. Certain situations make certain things as far as beer goes, and I believe that with food too.
Oh yeah, for sure.
Yeah, certain settings in restaurants or when you're on vacation or
right,
I think make things taste better.
Yeah, so I think maybe that beer, maybe it's not as good as I remember it just because of that situation, but it was pretty darn good. And I think that if you're going to Portland, if you're a beer-loving person, go to 10 Barrel, go upstairs, hang out on a deck, eat some dinner, some lunch, have a couple beers. Portland is a very eclectic city. I mean, everybody has their own style. Everybody has their own feel, you know, it's
it's like I said, it's very eclectic. Everybody's different. So it's enjoyable to go and see, you know, different types of people hanging out.
Yeah.
Together. But at any rate, that's my beer of the week. Steve, what do you got?
Well, I don't have near the story to go with mine as you did. I mean, I don't know, as we go through this, you run out of really good ones.
Yeah.
I mean, I've tried a lot of really bad ones, and you're not going to hear that from me, but.
Well, we've done enough IPAs.
We've said
maybe
that
we
too.
Should do a challenge for you and I, and that's to, from here on out, if we can try some other type of beer. I like sours. I like porters. I'm not a huge Hefeweizen fan, but
I'm not either. But some of them I do like. So
yeah. Maybe
what if
from
we were
here
to
on out,
okay. From here on out, maybe a couple weeks from now.
Yeah.
What if, let me just throw this out there. What if each week we bring a six-pack in?
Yeah.
After we're done with the podcast, you and I'll try it.
And then we'll
a different style of beer. Maybe we'll do a porter or a Hefeweizen, or maybe it can be a new IPA that we haven't tried. Instead of, I think through the weeks that we've done this now, we've been through a lot of really good beers that you and I enjoy that we've had.
Yep.
Now if you want to do this, let's try something that we have both never tried.
Yep.
And we'll just say whether we like it or not.
Yeah, and we'll make a little bit. I hate to say bad things about beers.
Well, just because we don't like it doesn't mean somebody else isn't going to like it. Our style, our favorite style is an IPA.
Yep.
But that'd be fun. Let's do that.
All right.
We'll finish our podcast. We'll drink a couple of those beers that we have never had. And then on the following week,
we'll report back.
Yeah. And we'll throw some different stuff in the mix.
Sounds good.
I'll buy 1 week, you buy the next week, and we'll go through and we'll do it way.
I'm going to start off with Jenny Cream Ale. I'm just kidding.
I've had that, but it's been years and years since.
I don't even remember what it tastes like.
Neither do I. But yeah, that sounds like something we should do.
All right. So that just happened right there. That was not pre-planned.
No.
But you still didn't answer the question.
Well.
What's your beer of the week?
I had a Founders beer while we were on vacation. I had a couple of them, actually. I don't remember if they were in a variety pack or what they were, but I had a Centennial, and it was okay.
Yeah, pretty good. I agree with that.
But I also had one of their Mosaic Promises, and it was really good. I really like that. Founders makes some really good beer, and they do make a stout that I really like.
Which one?
Their breakfast stout.
The Kentucky Breakfast Stout?
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's really good. But you're only drinking... That's the thing with me and stouts and some porters. You're
having one.
One, yep. It's like eating a meal.
I think if I were to drink less IPAs, I'd have less heartburn, too. I get heartburn from IPAs. I do. It's the acid in them.
Yeah.
There's a lot of acid in those hops.
Yeah, there is. But
they're called alpha acids for you guys that are trying to brew out there. So the amount of alpha acids plays a big part in your IBUs.
And that's what makes the beer taste really good.
Yeah.
So, yeah, it won't hurt us to... A couple weeks from now, I'll buy us a porter or something, and maybe even we'll start with a Hefeweizen.
Oh, man. Not many Hefeweizens I like. But I'm open. It's like banana to me.
Yeah, it does. It tastes... It has that banana hint to it. But.
I do like sours. You and I both like sours. Just not
some
too
of them.
Just like one sour.
Same thing, yeah.
Yeah. I could drink some porters or even some stouts.
We may have to buy a six-pack. you and I will each drink one to try it and then run a giveaway to give the other four.
If we don't like it enough. It's kind of like my brewing.
Okay, it's our four-pack giveaway.
Right. It's kind of like my brewing. If I like it, you're probably not going to get too many of them. But
yeah, I'll attest to that. Yeah, for sure.
If I don't like it, hey, buddy, come and share my beer with me.
Yeah.
So
that's the way it goes. So that's all right.
Yeah. So we've got some really cool podcasts coming up. I think next week we've got a friend coming in who's going out west to hunt elk.
Scott Coudry.
That's right.
We call him Cooter.
Yep.
Yeah.
And then the following week, we're going to have the Midwest Whitetail guys on.
Yep.
Aaron and Zach. They do the public land thing in Iowa, and they kill big bucks.
They absolutely kill it. Yeah. Boy, and they have some great footage of that stuff,
too. Really cool stuff, right?
Yeah.
I think you should get on there and check that out, too. Even beforehand, you can do it after. It doesn't matter. But we've got some cool things coming up. I'm excited.
Yeah.
So, as always, our podcast is brought to you by...
Cody and Steve.
Us two, you know. And like I said, I don't think that's going to change anytime soon. We're enjoying doing this. We enjoy that you guys listen. I think that if you can, go on to iTunes or Stitcher and leave us a review. Just because we'd like to know what's going on. What do you guys think? Send us an email. Go on to our website, www.theopenairproject.com. Leave us an email. You can do it right through the site and let us know what you think. If you think we BS too much, well, we probably won't change that. But, we'll listen to you. We will. I mean, we'll listen to what you think. And
yeah. And, like us. Or not. Let us know.
Yeah.
Fun podcast tonight. That was fun hanging out with those guys.
Yeah.
We got to travel to State College. And
yeah, and very knowledgeable people. I don't think we got the exact answers that everybody else was expecting to hear. I think in some certain circumstances, there were answers given that... you know, as a hunter, you're like, huh, that's not quite what I thought they were going to say.
Well.
But they're the scientists.
You're getting true data.
Yeah.
You're getting what they're studying, so you're getting their answers.
Right. And we really appreciate them coming on.
So. Oh, yeah. Getting true answers backed by science and data, that's...
I mean, what more can you ask for as a hunter?
Right. I thought it was really cool.
Well, tune in next week. And thanks for listening, everybody. Good night.
Good night.